We won the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Faith Perlow has a report on how Ukrainians are preparing for cold winter weather. Brian Lynn presents this week's science report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Faith Perlow.
As autumn sets in across the northern part of the world, Ukraine faces the winter months. Russia is targeting Ukrainian cities like Kyiv. Their power plants and other infrastructure using missiles and drones. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said on social media that over the past week, Russia has destroyed 30% of the country's power plants. This has caused massive blackouts across the country. As temperatures near 0 Celsius, Ukrainians who have not fled the war ready themselves for winter. Artem Panchenko is 9 years old. Recently, he helped his grandmother tend a fire in their temporary outdoor kitchen near their old apartment. Just like hundreds of thousands of other Ukrainians, Artem and his grandmother are facing difficult conditions. They have been living without natural gas, water, and electricity for about 3 weeks since Russian missiles cut off utilities in their town, which is in the Kharkiv area of eastern Ukraine. They survive by wearing warm clothes and cooking outside. As Artem helped his grandmother cook, he said, "It's really cold. I'm sleeping in my clothes in our apartment." Roman Semenuka is an official in the Kharkiv government. He said that officials are working to restore electricity to the area in the coming days, but that repairs to water and gas lines will come later. Officials are giving firewood to citizens instead. He said that only after water and gas lines are repaired will we be able to begin to restore heating. Viktor Palianitsa is 37 years old and lives in the nearby village of Kirillivka. He has gathered enough wood for the whole winter. He is not able to sleep in his home because all the windows were destroyed. He plans to sleep beside a wood-burning stove in an old building. He said that he is not waiting for the government's help. He is ready to provide for himself throughout the winter. "It's not comfortable. We spend a lot of time on gathering wood. You can see the situation we're living in. I have arms and legs, so I'm not scared of the cold, because I can find wood and heat the stove," Palianitsa said. Like Palianitsa, there are still thousands of Ukrainians living in homes that have been partly destroyed by Russian strikes, most with damaged roofs and windows. Officials in the Ukrainian-controlled area of Donetsk have told residents to leave the area and warned that services would not be returned by winter. Even in other areas of Ukraine, the threat of a winter without heat is real. Russian President Vladimir Putin has increased attacks on civilian energy centers after Ukraine's strike on an important bridge in Crimea. This has left many cities without electricity, including Kyiv, Sumy in the northeast, and Vinnytsia in the west. Many in the town of Kirillivka have created basic shelters where residents live by candlelight, gather water from wells, and wear warm clothes to stay alive. Irina Panchenko is Artem's grandmother. The two have been sleeping in an abandoned apartment next to their home because a Russian strike destroyed their windows. It's very cold living here. It's hard to cook. It's hard to run between the apartment and where we cook. My legs hurt, Irina Panchenko said. Basic structures are a common sight along the apartment complex. Residents gather wood for fires so that they can cook outside. Anton Serikov is 47 years old, and his mother is disabled. He helps her with daily tasks, like heating water over the fire for tea. No electricity, no water, no gas. We are cold. I'm making tea for my mother on the fire, but she only drinks a little bit to warm up for a short time. His mother, Zoya Serikova, had been unable to leave her bed for 7 years, and most of the time she keeps seated, playing cards. It's really cold now. If it weren't for my son, I would freeze, she said. Serukov said that he has asked a friend from Kharkiv to purchase an electric heater for them, in case the power is restored. The thought of surviving a winter in this state is almost too much to think about. I hope we'll have electricity soon, so we can live through this winter somehow, Serukov said. I'm Faith Perlow.
Next, we hear this week's science report with Brian Lynn. Listen closely. There will be a quiz question for you after the report.
The American Space Agency, NASA, says its Curiosity vehicle has reached its next exploration target on Mars. The Explorer, or rover, reached an area that NASA scientists call Mount Sharp. The area sits within the planet's Gale Crater, which Curiosity has been exploring since landing on Mars in 2012. Mount Sharp contains a mix of rocky material and many large hills. In the past, researchers have found evidence that billions of years ago, Mount Sharp contained many water systems. At some point, scientists believe the Martian climate grew more extreme and caused the water systems to dry up. NASA says the minerals still existing around Mount Sharp might provide additional evidence of the severe climate changes. Today, Mars is an extremely cold desert that cannot support any running water systems. Experiments carried out on the minerals could help researchers learn more about the kinds of life that may have existed on Mars when it had conditions more similar to Earth. NASA currently operates two rovers on Mars. The other vehicle, Perseverance, landed in February 2021. It is exploring areas around the planet's Jezero crater. The space agency estimated the landing site for Perseverance was about 3,700 kilometers away from where Curiosity touched down. NASA also operates the InSight lander on Mars. NASA said in a statement that the minerals around Mount Sharp were first discovered by the agency's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter years before Curiosity landed. Scientists have been waiting a long time to get a closer look. Shortly after arriving in the area, Curiosity's instruments discovered a wide range of different rock kinds and sizes. Among the findings were several different salt materials that suggest past signs of water in the area, NASA says. To examine rocks, Curiosity uses a drill at the end of its robotic arm to dig into the Martian surface. The rover has already drilled many holes on Mars. The latest drilling happened on October 3rd. The Curiosity team chose a rock it named Canaima for the operation. The rover has recently experienced problems with a braking system that permits the robotic arm to mostly stay in place. NASA said this can cause difficulties during drilling, but it reported that Curiosity's 36th drill hole was a success. The team of scientists are now looking forward to examining the latest Martian dust collection. The space agency noted that Curiosity's path to Mount Sharp included areas containing treacherous or risky areas. In August, the rover safely made its way through a sandy area situated between high hills. Sand presents a major risk for Curiosity because of the chance of getting stuck. Sharp rocks can also damage the rover's wheels. Ground-based rover drivers need to carefully navigate these areas, NASA said. The agency noted that it took Curiosity more than a month to reach its target area. After reaching its goal, however, the team was treated with some of the best images ever taken by the rover. Curiosity's so-called mast cam was able to capture extremely wide or panoramic views of the Martian surroundings. "We would get new images every morning and just be in awe," said Elena Amador French. She oversees work by Curiosity's science and engineering teams at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. "The sand ridges were gorgeous," she added. "You see perfect little rover tracks on them, and the cliffs were beautiful. We really got close to the walls." Last month, NASA celebrated Curiosity's 10th anniversary in service. During that time, it said the rover has driven nearly 29 kilometers and climbed about 625 meters while exploring Gale Crater. I'm Brian Lynn.
Now, try to answer this question. What does the story say the minerals around Mount Sharp might provide evidence of? Is it A, severe changes affecting the Martian atmosphere. B. Running water systems in areas around Mount Sharp. Or C. Severe climate changes Mars has experienced. If you answered C, you are correct. Answer more questions about Brian's report by visiting our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to the Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The United States declared war on Britain in 1812. It did so because Britain refused to stop seizing American ships that traded with France, Britain's enemy in Europe. Sometimes there were also seizures of American sailors. These seizures were known as impressment. Britain finally suspended its orders against neutral trade after a change in government. But the British acted too late. The United States had already declared war. Today, we continue the story of the War of 1812. Most of Britain's forces were battling the soldiers of Napoleon Bonaparte in Europe. Historian and Pulitzer Prize winner Alan Taylor says that as a result, the British could send only a small force to the United States.
And so the British were basically fighting the war against the United States on the defensive in Canada while trying to raid the American coast using their advantage in the more powerful Royal Navy.
For its part, the United States was far from ready to fight. The country had not fought a war or needed an army for a long time. There were only 8,000 American soldiers. The soldiers, who were young, knew little about war. And the officers who knew about war were old enough to have led troops in the American Revolution. President James Madison named two top generals, 62-year-old Henry Dearborn and 63-year-old Thomas Pinckney. The United States had only a few warships and gunboats with which to face the British Navy, the most powerful naval force in the world. Historian and professor Alan Taylor says the American people were divided about the war.
A majority of them supported the Madison administration and agreed that they tried the embargo, it had failed, and that something had to be done because national honor, they felt, was at stake, and that they needed to stop the British practice of impressment. And they were also upset about the British military aid to these Indian peoples who were restricting American expansion.
Alan Taylor says, for those reasons, many Americans supported the war, particularly in the southern, western, and mid-Atlantic states.
But in New England, most of the people supported the opposition party, the Federalists, and they were very bitter about the war. They felt that it was really being waged for illegitimate reasons, that diplomacy could have just papered over the disagreement over impressment. And so they did their best to obstruct the war effort. They not only didn't want to contribute to the war effort, but they wanted to block it as best they could.
Church bells were rung and flags were lowered in New England when the declaration of war was announced. There was also the problem of getting enough men to serve as soldiers. Congress had approved an increase of 25,000 men. Only 5,000 agreed to serve. Members of Congress from the western states had spoken proudly of how their people would rush to fight the British. This did not happen. The first request to Kentucky for soldiers produced only 400 men. Historian Alan Taylor says that some states in the Northeast did not offer any soldiers at all, especially for invasions into Canada.
And even when the governors would cooperate, as did, for example, the governor of New York, the militia would often march to the border and then decide that their constitutional duty was only to defend their state and not to help the United States invade another country. And so they'd go on a sit-down strike once they got to the border.
Nevertheless, an American general named William Hull led 2,000 men across the Canadian border. But the British general there was prepared, and the attack failed. Although Hull had the stronger force and plenty of supplies, he retreated to Detroit. He was chased by a smaller force of British soldiers and Indians. After the war, Hull was tried by a military court on charges of cowardice. The court found him guilty and ordered him shot. But President Madison, because of Hull's service during the Revolutionary War, permitted the old soldier to live. The next American attack was made from Fort Niagara, a military post in New York on the shore of Lake Ontario. A small group of American soldiers crossed the Niagara River and attacked the British. But some Americans from New York refused to cross the border to help against the British. They calmly watched as British soldiers shot down the attacking Americans. The third campaign was made by General Henry Dearborn. He led a state militia force from Plattsburgh, New York, to the Canadian border. He was planning to cross the border and attack Montreal. But again, the soldiers refused to cross the border. Dearborn could do nothing but march them back to Plattsburgh. British forces at this time were winning victories. They captured an American fort in northern Michigan, and Indians fighting for the British captured a fort at the place now known as Chicago. Instead of marching through Canada without difficulty, the Americans found themselves trying hard to keep the British out of the state of Ohio. For a while, the small American Navy was doing better than the Army. Just 2 months after the war started, the United States warship Constitution forced a British ship to surrender. Several months later, another American ship, the Wasp, captured the British ship Frolic. Then a frigate named the United States defeated one of Britain's most famous fighting ships, the Macedonian. The British ship was captured and brought to the United States. There were other victories at sea. At the end of 6 months, the United States Navy had captured 6 British ships and lost only one of its own vessels. Private American trade ships had been armed with guns when the war started. They, too, were successful against the British. They captured more than 300 British trade ships. But the American successes forced Britain to bring more of its fighting ships into the war with the United States. By the middle of 1813, a year after the war started, British ships controlled the East Coast. No American ship could enter or leave any port south of New England. Meanwhile, the military situation was improving for the Americans in what was then the West. William Henry Harrison, governor of the Indiana Territory, formed a large force to try to capture Detroit from the British. At the same time, Captain Oliver Perry built 5 warships on Lake Erie. With these, and 4 he already had, Perry met and defeated a British naval force. Perry reported his victory to Harrison. "We have met the enemy, and they are ours." Perry's victory and Harrison's large force caused the British to withdraw from Detroit and from a British fort at Malton in Canada. Harrison's men continued to chase the enemy. They caught them and defeated them in the Battle of the Tens. Killed in this battle was the great Indian chief Tecumseh, who had been fighting for the British. American forces made new attempts to win control of Lake Ontario and invade Canada across the Niagara River. But none of these succeeded. Late in 1813, British soldiers crossed the river and captured Fort Niagara. They also burned the town of Buffalo. By April 1814, Napoleon was forced from power in Europe, and the war between France and Britain was over. The end of the war in Europe permitted Britain to send many of its soldiers to fight against the United States. About 4,000 British soldiers landed on the Chesapeake coast, southeast of Washington. They met American forces inland at Bladensburg, a town 10 kilometers from Washington. The British soldiers broke through the American lines, and the Americans began to run away. But a group of sailors refused to retreat with their artillery. Commanded by Joshua Barney, the 400 sailors chose to stand and fight. The struggle did not last long against the 4,000 British soldiers. Barney held his position for a half hour before enemy soldiers got behind his men and silenced their guns. Barney was wounded seriously. The British thought so much of his courage that they carried him to a hospital for their own soldiers at Bladensburg. Barney himself said the British officers treated him as a brother. Once the British troops had smashed through Barney's Navy men, nothing stood between them and Washington. The commanders of the British force, General Robert Ross and Admiral George Cockburn, took a group of men to the Capitol building and set fire to it. Then the two commanders went to the White House with the same intention. Before setting fire to the president's home, Cockburn took one of Madison's hats and the seat from one of Dolly Madison's chairs. The admiral found the president's table set for dinner. As a joke, he took a glass of wine and toasted the health of President Jemmy. President Madison had fled the White House. He crossed the Potomac River and started toward his home in Virginia. He joined his wife on the road the second day. They decided to wait about 25 kilometers from Washington. When President Madison returned to the Capitol 3 days later, the British had withdrawn. They had also burned most public buildings.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.